morning to everyone in the Diocese of Orange and elsewhere in Southern California. You're listening to Orange County Catholic Radio on AM 1000 in Orange and San Diego counties and on AM 930 in Los Angeles County. We're coming to you through the good offices of Immaculate Heart Radio today and every Thursday morning from 11 to noon from our studios on the campus of Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove. I'm Patrick Mott. Well, when you were a little kid, one of the ways you learned about the world was by experiencing it in a hands-on way. You became familiar with various subjects and things by seeing them, picking them up, touching them, and getting to know them up close. This firsthand philosophy is part of a unique approach to religious education for small children that is having excellent success in various schools in the Diocese of Orange. It's called Catechesis of the Good Shepherd. And here this morning to tell us about it is our friend Katie Dawson. Katie is the Director of Parish Faith Formation for the Diocese of Orange, and she's had many opportunities to see how Catechesis of the Good Shepherd has worked. With her is Rose Antonioli, the Director of Faith Formation at St. Vincent de Paul Church in Huntington Beach, where the program has been enjoying good success. Katie and Rose, welcome back to Orange County Catholic Radio, and thanks for taking time to be with us.
Thank you, Pat. It's good to be here.
Thank you.
Well, Katie, let's start with you. This approach is based on Montessori principles. Can you explain that for us a little bit?
Well, the philosophy of Montessori education is that each child learns through exploring the environment and the knowledge base that's provided to them. So when we say that Catechesis of the Good Shepherd is based on Montessori principles, we've applied, or Sophia Cavalletti, the founder of Catechesis of the Good Shepherd, has applied those principles to bringing the faith to the fore for children and allowing them to explore their relationship with God, which actually is pre-existent to coming to Catechesis of the Good Shepherd. In other words, every child already has a relationship with God. What we do in Catechesis of the Good Shepherd is we help them to explore, deepen, and develop that relationship.
That relationship with God is just assumed going in, huh?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, that's foundational then. Well, classes are held in what's called an atrium. What's significant about that?
The atrium is a special place where the child comes to meet Jesus, and the materials are age-appropriate. The tables, the chairs are sized according to this child's age. And there in the atrium, it's a place where the child, they walk quietly, they speak softly, and they come to know Jesus and can hear his voice in this special room.
Okay, now, this is not a classroom per se. It's set up specifically for this purpose, right?
Yes, we don't call it a classroom. And so what the child does is they come in and there's a prayer table. There's a model altar table where they can start to learn the articles that are used at Mass. There's the gestures. They begin, even at age three, to learn what the gesture of epiclesis and offering. And the first parable they hear is the parable of the Good Shepherd and how the Good Shepherd calls them by name, and he knows and they know his voice. And that is where that relationship, where that really starts to foster that relationship with the child, is through that parable of the Good Shepherd, because the children know that that Good Shepherd loves and cares for them.
Well, now you're saying this is a fairly quiet place. The kids are walking quietly, they're talking quietly. Is this a tough thing for a lot of little kids to do in a group?
Maybe in the beginning, but we have works in there, which we call practical life, and people will say, oh, what does spooning grains and pouring liquids have to do with Jesus? But it helps to quiet that three-year-old while they've already heard the word, the parable, the one of the infancy narratives, or whatever presentation they were given, and then they're able to take that presentation and go and do something in the atrium to reflect on it more. So for the youngest child, they might spoon beans or pour grains or sweep or draw a picture about what they heard. And that helps them to slow down because they come from very busy worlds where they're always running and moving, and catechesis provides that very quiet place place where they can just come and meet Jesus.
Well, now you have a lot of materials in the atrium, obviously, you know, in order to keep everybody occupied. Putting an atrium together is a pretty labor-intensive project for the catechists, I'd imagine, yes?
Well, one of the things that I just recently told a group of people learning about catechesis of the Good Shepherd is, how do you eat an elephant? You do it one bite at a time. Mm-hmm. So when you look at the number of materials and the furnishings that are needed for an atrium, yes, it can be a little intimidating. But what we've seen over the last 5 or 6 years here in the Diocese of Orange is that bit by bit, you put together the space. And in fact, we already spend a tremendous amount of money on textbooks in classrooms. Every year we invest money, a substantial amount of money in textbooks for traditional classrooms. Mm-hmm. Once an atrium is established, there are no textbooks in an atrium. There are simply the materials, and then the children receive the presentations or the work of the atrium, and they do their own work with those presentations. So once the investment to set up an atrium has been made, it's pretty cost effective.
And it also depends on your budget. If you have a very small budget, then you're not going to have the Ritz-Carlton of atriums. Your atrium will be a lot simpler. I mean, catechesis is all over the world in third world countries. And so they might have stick figures as their material for the Annunciation or the Good Shepherd, where some of us might have the an actual figure that we already bought, or we purchased them and we just have to paint them. So it fits any kind of budget, any kind of culture. Catechesis is able to work. It's in over 60 countries in the world, and we've just celebrated our 60th anniversary, so it's not something new. It's been around since 1954, which is, to me, was amazing. I wish I would have found out about it, you know, 20 years ago when I started as a director.
Well, the catechists go through some fairly intensive training in order to become catechists of the Good Shepherd. But this is an educational approach where the teachers tend to lay a foundation and then kind of pull back and get out of the way and let the kids kind of take the lead themselves. Is that so?
Well, I think we're co-wanderers with the child. Mm-hmm. So we teach, or not teach, we actually proclaim the word, and then we sit back and contemplate it together with the child. So what is amazing about it is we are able to hear back from the child what we proclaimed, and to hear their experience with reading or listening, or how the Good Shepherd is speaking to them.
Well, the program doesn't just have an impact on kids. It also has an impact on catechists and parents as well, I suppose. Is that so?
Yes, that's definitely true. The child frequently brings home the word and proclaims it to their parents, and we see that families are really impacted by the journey of the child in their relationship with God, and what the child is capable of in their relationship with God, and what they have to say. And of course, we know children, they tend to hold us accountable for the things that we say are important. And they remind us that, didn't we say we're going to go to church on
mm-hmm,
Sunday?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't we?
Can't fudge it.
Right. Shouldn't we say grace before we have our meal? And they really respond to the notion that we have this tremendous gift of life from God, and that we want to give back gratitude to God. So they're very in touch with that notion of gratitude, and they bring it to the family.
I don't think we have mentioned so far the age group that this is aimed at. What is the age range?
So there are three levels in Catechesis of the Good Shepherd. Level one is ages 3 to 6. Level 2 is ages 6 to 9, and level 3 is ages 9 to 12. So with each level, there's a maturing, a growing in the approach of the presentations. So with the smallest children, the presentations are simplified. And by the time a child is in level 3, Catechesis the Good Shepherd, they're doing a lot of the learning and the working on their own.
We call it a spiraling method. So take the child that's at age 3. When you present the gesture of epiclesis to them, you're really just showing them that gesture of the hands coming down over the body, over the bread and the wine. Mm-hmm. And in level 2, you're taking that gesture and you're teaching them the words that is actually said at Mass. And then we take those articles that they learn in level 1 that are used at Mass, the chalice, the paten. And in level 2, we do what we call synthesis of the Mass, where they take all of those articles and we take all of those prayers and we put them together and find an order. And then in level 3, they even go deeper. They start to learn about the preface. They start to learn all of these prayers that are said and the different ones that are said for different seasons or different feast days. And so it just keeps going deeper and deeper and deeper.
Fantastic. Well, we have about a minute left here. Give us a couple of quick shots about feedback you've gotten on the program.
Well, Rose has a lot of stories to tell, but we'll give her a little time.
Okay. In our parish, we've been doing level 1 for 7 years, level 2, 5, and we're very excited to be starting level 3 this fall. The parents are very well involved in catechesis. They are participating. They're coming to family nights. They're coming to Mass, and they're praying as a family.
Well, Katie Dawson and Rose Antignoli, many thanks for being with us this morning, and much good luck with the growth of Catechesis of the Good Shepherd.
Thank you so much, Pat.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll be visiting with another familiar friend of Orange County Catholic Radio, Dr. Vincent Nguyen, who's going to talk with us about a familiar piece of problematic legislation in Sacramento that just doesn't seem to want to go away. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Many of our listeners will recall that for much of the last several months, one of the most hotly debated pieces of legislation in Sacramento was SB 128, the so-called physician-assisted suicide bill. The measure, which would allow California doctors to prescribe lethal doses of drugs to terminally ill patients, appeared to have some early support, but just last month it wilted when it could not find enough support in the 19-member Assembly Health Committee. It was initially thought that the bill was dead for the remainder of 2015, but it has been reintroduced in almost identical form as ABX215. Here with us to talk about how the bill is going is Dr. Vincent Nguyen. Dr. Nguyen is a hospice and palliative care specialist and an assistant clinical professor at UC Irvine. He has also been an eloquent voice in opposition to physician-assisted suicide, and I would like to welcome him back to Orange County Catholic Radio. Dr. Nguyen, welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Pat. Thanks for having me back on the show again.
Our pleasure. Well, we thought this bill was dead for at least a few more months, at least into next year. What happened?
We just know that the proponent of the bill, they're very steadfast in their pursuit of passing this legislation to legalize assisted suicide with the aid of the physician. And we know that with their persistency, they're going to do whatever it takes, sometimes bypassing the regular legislative movement and just get to the point of making this proposal something very real. And that is a very scary thought. Not allows people to really think it over, but try to jam it down people's throat, which I think is a reason for us to strongly oppose even further.
Well, they use a special legislative session called by Governor Brown in order to introduce this, right? It sort of came out of left field, didn't it?
Yeah, there's this special session on healthcare financing.
Yes.
And yes, this falls under financial piece, and this gives us a great concern as if things are too expensive, probably it's cheaper just to just bypass your life and just end it. And here's medications that's a lot cheaper than treating. This is my first take from this, and I thought I was completely horrified last week. And I thought, boy, we need to speak out against this even further.
Well, in just a minute, we're going to read part of a statement on this from the Californians Against Assisted Suicide. But for the moment, the proponents of this bill claim that California voters are in favor of it. They're in favor of physician-assisted suicide. Well, they've said that if the bill doesn't pass this time out, they'll reintroduce it next year. And if it doesn't pass then, they want to get the measure on the ballot and the California election. electorate will decide. Do you think it's going to come to that, or do you think the California voters are actually in favor of it, or do you think it's destined to die out eventually?
I don't think it's going to die out, but I think it's important that those who practice in the field of hospice and palliative medicine, and for clinicians to step and say, look, you know, we need to have a better increase in access to better care to support people suffering from terminal illness, rather than making an exit and say, look, you know, you're going to suffer and die anyway, so why don't you just end your life and just make things easier for everyone? And that's a very unfortunate way of thinking. And there's, when we talk about death and dying, people often have all these myths about how uncomfortable things are. And being in this field for 21 years, we journey with the patients and family through this course. And yes, there's no doubt there's some pain and there's going to be some discomfort. But I have to say that these pain and discomfort can be handled with medications and with support, both physically, emotionally, psychologically, and for some even spiritually. So the treatment is really in caring for the whole person. And let's learn, let's not make the same mistake of the organs making that the sick and the aging deserves a much better care than just putting them to death.
Yeah, I was going to guess that the principal argument, just as you said, in the minds of a lot of people out there who say that they favor this bill, is that physician-assisted suicide is going to alleviate unnecessary suffering. That was the thinking, I think, behind the Oregon bill and several other individual instances. But you're a palliative care specialist, and you've looked into this deeply and thoroughly over the course of several years, and you don't buy that argument at all, do you?
I do not. I think when it comes to death and dying, there's a lot of fear. It conjures up a lot of concerns, and I think it's best that we care for the people and listen to their concerns, and let's address the myths. There are so many myths around death and dying. People think that, oh my gosh, it's going to be the worst thing imaginable, and there's really, and we know that death and it is part of life. For some people, well, it's something that for us to embrace because it's what it is. But I do see that as an opportunity in the face of no cure. There are still healing that takes place at the end of life. You don't get rid of life. You don't alleviate the sufferer. Our goal is to alleviate the suffering that the person is suffering from, and providing that support for the family. This is where we need to stand up. And not only the suffering, but I also am afraid of what this means for the vulnerable members of our society who may be at risk for assisted suicide if it's even legal in the state. So we're dealing with 2-3 different issues here, not for just the dying, but also the second piece is for the vulnerable members. And the third piece, I know I'm not sure we have enough time to discuss this, is it certainly will change the relationship between doctors and patients. So these are the three themes that I often think of when I think of assisted suicide and how that, especially the relationship. When you talk about physician-assisted suicide here, what are we telling our the members of society that, you know, your life's not worth living, or, you know, there's nothing we can do, so why don't we just steer you toward assisted suicide? And what does that mean? You know, even when patients go and see their doctor, and with the doctor saying, you know, they will certainly be in that mistrust, which I'm concerned about. And that's not why, as doctors, why we go into medicine in the first place. After 4 years of medical school and at least 3 years of residency and then training and fellowships, et cetera, you know, this is not why we go into medicine. So there's really, I as physicians, I'm just abhorred by this bill.
Well, I mentioned a minute ago that I wanted to quote from a statement by Californians Against Assisted Suicide, and I want to do that now. Californians Against Assisted Suicide is a coalition of disability rights groups, medical professionals, other health groups. It also includes the California Catholic Conference, among others. And here's what they said recently about this, and I'm quoting. It is particularly troubling that in this rush to judgment, proponents are linking this bill with health care financing. That should be truly frightening to those on Medi-Cal and subsidized health care who quite logically fear a system where prescribing suicide pills could be elevated to a treatment option. Now, this is exactly what you were just talking about, the trust and the bond between patient and physician. This is something you've been talking about all along, isn't it? The idea, you know, simply is saving money by prescribing lethal drugs.
Absolutely. And that was very eloquently said, and I don't think I could say it any better than what you just did.
And again, backing up for a second to what you said a moment ago about palliative care. Again, I think this is probably an idea in many minds that is going to be a little bit difficult to overcome, because there are all these stories, true or not, out there of people suffering at the end of life. And the state of the art and science right now is such, and I'm hoping you'll tell us a little more about this, that doesn't have to be so. You don't necessarily have to be doped to the earlobes in order to get through a terminal illness. You can get through it in reasonably good shape, yes?
Absolutely. The idea behind palliative medicine is not prescribed medication where the patient is completely unable to communicate or unable to function. The idea behind medicine is to help the person function as best that they can. And medications are prescribed for patients for pain, such as morphine, or for anxiety, such as Ativan. Yes, these medications are sedating. But the purpose behind the medication is to help relieve the pain, the shortness of breath, the anxiety. People often think of morphine and Ativan are the common medication where we put people to death or speed up the dying process. I can tell you morphine and Ativan are bad drugs to, you know, if you're going to meant to kill somebody with it. And that's not the reason why the morphine or Ativan is given. You have to be taking a lot of doses to make that happen. But the dose that we use to help people function are very, you know, we go low, we go slow, but we go to advance it to the point where the patient is having the pain relieved as best that we can with, you know, with trying to deal with their underlying pain. Most of the pain for patients are usually for patients with cancer, patients with long-term chronic degenerative joint disease. We can certainly help with that. Those are the two type of pains that we often see that requires opioid. But there are other type of pains, such as the emotional, the psychological anguish of the dying phase, where morphine and Ativan may not help, but the ability for social workers, for psychologists, for that emotional support for the family will often supersede the need for medications. And it's that support that's often neglected when we don't have palliative medicine involved.
And also, too, when you're talking about that sort of care, that is something that certainly falls under the purview of trust and bonding between the physician and the patient, which would be undermined by this bill.
Absolutely. You know, I think of as a geriatrician, besides a palliative care physician, I take care of the older people. We want to make sure that these folks are free from coercions. And we often hear that, you know, from the experience from Oregon, where families start going doctor shopping, where they're tired of caring for their loved ones, and they're saying, you're costing too much money. Let's go and find a doctor who's willing to just prescribe me a drug to help speed up this process. There was a really beautiful article published by the Wall Street Journal this past week by Dr. William Toffler, who's a physician who practices in Oregon, and he says, look, he mentioned about the changes in relationship between a doctor and a patient. He also talked about the people who are depressed, they're not getting the psychological support that they should be getting. And he mentioned something about three of the 105 patients who died this past year who had psychological or underlying depression, mental illness, even were referred for a psychological exam. In other words, less than 3% of these patients who have underlying depression, instead of being referred to a psychiatrist or a psychologist to help them, they were automatically given the medications and to help them die. That should be a huge concern. When we talk about those who are at risk to be manipulated, you might say.
Well, obviously, there is much more to talk about on the subject, but we are out of time, unfortunately. And Dr. Vincent Nguyen, thank you so much again for taking time to be with us today and for continuing the good fight against physician-assisted suicide.
Thank you very much, Pat.
We'll continue to keep a close eye on this issue and let our listeners know the latest. We'll be right back after this. Don't go away. Welcome Welcome back to Orange County Catholic Radio. Here with us in the studio is Dr. Ronald Knowles, the past president of the Orange County chapter of the Knights of Columbus. Many of our listeners, I'm sure, are quite familiar with the Knights, but others may know them only from seeing them in their very colorful ceremonial garb at such occasions as church dedications and other special and significant ceremonies and rites of the church. Of course, the Knights are much more than this, and Dr. Knowles is going to fill us in about that. Dr. Knowles, welcome to the show, and many thanks for coming down to the studio to chat with us today.
It's my honor to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, the Knights of Columbus is 133 years old this year, if my arithmetic is correct. Tell us how and why the order got started.
Our order was started by Father Michael J. McGivney, who is a Catholic parish priest at the time in Connecticut, and it was his desire to start an organization that would help especially widows and orphans of the men at that particular point in time that might have been injured or suffered death in a mine accident or industrial accident. They had nobody to help them. And so he started this in the basement of St. Mary's Church to establish the Knights of Columbus, and that was one of the first things that was to help the widows and orphans and also to bring the men closer to the church.
Well, now the order operates under four guiding principles. They are charity, unity, fraternity, and patriotism. I'm going to ask you to put a little flesh on those principles for us. What are their particular meanings for modern Knights of Columbus?
Charity, I think, is our primary principle. Giving is the greatest virtue, as the Irish often say, and we're certainly a believer in that. And one of our main goals that we do, we have certain programs from our Supreme Office in Connecticut and from the state of California. We do things for Coats for Kids, Food for Families. In the Diocese of Orange especially, we raise about $150,000 each year for a camp for the intellectually disabled that's put on by Catholic Charities.
That's Camp Recreation,
Camp
correct?
Recreation.
We just talked about that on the show last week, as a matter of fact. Yes. Please go on.
And some people call that the Tootsie Roll Drive. We stand out in front of a church and give you a Tootsie Roll and hope you'll give us a couple of dollars for the camp. And that is one of our main goals. We also are helping with Special Olympics and World Games just in about a couple of weeks in Los Angeles. That is another one of our charities that we work with. We also do a lot for the individual parishes and churches and schools. We help out a variety of the schools and whatever they might happen to need. We don't have an unlimited amount of money, but we're there to help our parish and our schools.
Well, the unity and fraternity part, I imagine, is pretty self-explanatory considering the history of the order, right?
That's correct. We tend to know that obviously if we stay united, we can accomplish more than we could if it was just one person. Fraternity basically is our friendship and our sharing with our brother knights, good times and bad times. We're always there. We are a family.
And patriotism, of course.
Patriotism is the fourth degree of the order, which I'm sure many of your listeners have seen. We're the ones with the chapeau and the sword that you see at confirmations, and we escort the bishop to many different events. And that's something, the kids think we're pirates, so they like to take pictures with us and say, gee, Dad, I got a picture of a pirate today.
Well, those outfits are unique, I think, in all fraternal organizations, and they're immediately identifiable with the order.
We are the visible arm of the order. They were patterned after 1800s naval uniforms, and it is a lot of fun. It's something, if you join the fourth degree, you don't have to be in a color corps, but it's one of the most fun things that we do. At the Christ Cathedral Assembly this year, we put on a school flag program. We went out to 8 of our parish schools. We talked about how the Knights of Columbus were basically responsible for putting under God in the Pledge of Allegiance, and we talked about that and gave each of the students a flag, and it was a lot of fun. The students enjoyed it, and we got a big kick out of being there with them.
Well, I think some of our listeners may not know what you mean when you say the fourth degree. Give us a little background on that.
The fourth degree was set up for patriotism, for things like getting out the vote, helping with the census, helping with veterans. We put on a picnic each year for the Veterans Hospital in Long Beach. We go out and cook our hamburgers and hot dogs and visit with the veterans and have a good time doing that as one of the things that we do for patriotism. And, of course, again, the Pledge of Allegiance.
And does it take a certain amount of time in order to become a fourth degree?
Several years ago, we used to have a waiting period of time. It used to be a year from the time you first joined.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's no longer a waiting period. So somebody could become a fourth degree knight in a matter of a few months if they so desired.
Ah, okay. Well, the KFC website describes the members of the order as, this is a quote, men of faith and men of action. Your level of personal involvement and the amount of charitable contributions remains very high, correct?
It does. We have done very well, I think, within the Diocese of Orange, the Knights of Columbus, and our various councils that are in almost every parish. Probably contribute close to $250,000 annually to Camp Recreation, for example, wheelchairs for veterans, for Perry schools, for seminarian scholarships. We support a large number of our seminarians and religious brothers and sisters that are studying for going to the priesthood and becoming a religious brother or sister.
Well, it says a lot, though, that you are not simply men of faith or not simply men of action. You are putting those two principles together and really making them work.
I think you're very correct in that. We are a faith-based organization. We are a Catholic organization. We start our meetings with a prayer. We end our meetings with a prayer. One of our mottos is we stand in solidarity with our priests and bishops. We certainly support them at every opportunity. We are here to help Bishop Bann in whatever he might ask of us. We do the best we can to support our parish priests. And again, I look at it basically in four areas. It is faith. If you join the Knights of Columbus, guaranteed you'll become a better Catholic. There's no question about that. I think it makes you a better father. I think it makes you a better husband. We're involved with family. We have a lot of family activities. We have picnics. We have, obviously, the pancake breakfast. We have our ID drives where we collect money. A lot of different family events that we have. We also have friendship, which, again, is a networking with men of like-minded values and interests. And the fourth one that I like to enjoy is fun. We're a fun organization. You join us, we're going to have fun. You don't join to go to a meeting. You don't join to listen to somebody talk to you. You join because you want to have fun. And that's what we try to do in our meetings and events. We try to have fun. We try to have fun with the family.
Well, respect for life issues, as I get it, are very important to the order. You have several culture of life programs that have been initiated by the Knights. Can you tell us a little bit about those various culture of life initiatives?
We have a very good ultrasound program that the Knights of Columbus at the Supreme Office will match 50-50 the funds raised to get an ultrasound machine for Birth Choice and for other organizations like that, so that the young lady coming in actually gets a chance to see the baby. And the statistics vary, but it's somewhere between 80% and 90% of the woman that sees the child in an ultrasound keeps the child. And that's one of the great things that we do is an ultrasound initiative. We were there at the Walk for Life in Los Angeles. We go to San Francisco. We go to San Diego. We support those things in terms. We have a very active culture of life program within the Orange chapter. Bernie Vicious is our chairman, and he does a fantastic job for us.
Well, who can become a knight? And once they become a knight, what can they expect? What's the process like of becoming a knight? And once they're in, what is it like week to week, month to month to be a knight?
Basically, to be a Knight of Columbus, you have just a few requirements. You have to be a male 18 or older, and you have to be in a practical Catholic, someone who is union with the Holy See, with the papacy, mm-hmm. and the values of our church. And if you meet those simple qualifications, you join the Knights of Columbus. And our dues for most of the councils range anywhere from $30, $40 a year. It's not an expensive organization.
No.
And we teach you through our principles of charity, unity, fraternity, and patriotism. We teach you about the Knights of Columbus. And those are what are called our degrees, our first, second, third, and fourth degrees. First degree is charity. Second degree is unity. We teach you about doing things together. And then once you have joined, basically, a lot of men say, oh, I don't have time. I don't have time to join the Knights. I've got kids, and they're in soccer, and they're in volleyball, and they're in 55 other different things. I just don't have time.
Right.
And my response basically to them is, just pick something you'd like to have fun with. You like to cook, join us at a pancake breakfast for an hour a year. Help with the parish fiesta for a couple hours a year. Whatever you'd like to do. We do a communion breakfast where we come together at Mass, we sit together, we go to communion. When we're done, we go out and have a nice brunch somewhere. Come join us with your family and do that. You can put as much or as little time as you have in it. If you're busy, maybe you only have a few hours a year. If you have more time and you want to spend a few hours a month, we can sure use you.
Well, in about the minute or so we have left, how about a little bit of contact information for some of our listeners who might be out there and might be considering joining the Knights?
One thing, they can go to our Orange Chapter website, which is OCKC.net, OCKC.net, and that will get to the chapter website. If you're interested in joining, there's information there. You can click on our membership request form, and we will be overjoyed to contact you and speak with you and give you whatever information that you need. You can reach me on that website too, and we're more than happy to explain to you the principles of our order and how much fun you can have.
Lastly, and I want to just hit this kind of quickly, we didn't touch on it right at the top more than just a couple of seconds, but you have a wonderful insurance program.
We do. We have a fantastic insurance program that's available only to members of the Knights of Columbus. It is one of the very top-ranked programs, insurance programs in the United States. It always gets fantastic reviews. Excellent program for the Knights of Columbus. You don't have to purchase the insurance, but it's a fantastic bargain if you do.
One of the highest rated in the world. And for information, once again, that is OCKC.net. Dr. Ronald Knowles, many thanks for joining us today on Orange County Catholic Radio. Once more on that contact information, OCKC.net. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Please stay with us. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back. With us on the phone for our final segment today is Father Stephen Washko. He is the pastor of Annunciation Byzantine Catholic Church in Anaheim, one of the most beautiful churches in the Diocese of Orange, and one of the more unique and fascinating in terms of liturgy, at least if you're accustomed to Roman Catholic liturgy about every Sunday. Father, welcome, and thanks so much for taking time to be with us today.
Great to be here.
Well, first of all, Father, for those of our listeners who may not be familiar, the Byzantine Catholic Church is indeed a Catholic Church differentiated from the Roman Rite. Give us a little background on some of the most visible and important characteristics of the Byzantine Catholic Church, maybe a little history and a little of what people see today.
Okay, first, you know, we are under the Holy Father, and we acknowledge the Holy Father as the primacy of Peter and the head of the Church.
In full communion with Rome.
In full communion with Rome. And the Holy Father is in communion with the Byzantine Catholic Church. Our history is originally Orthodox, and we came in communion with Rome back in the 14th century. And it was not only the Ruthenian Byzantine Church, but also the Ukrainian Byzantine Church and some of the other Eastern Catholic churches that were originally Orthodox that came in communion with Rome. The unions were important because, again, the people felt that to complete their orthodoxy or their Catholicity, it was to be in communion with the Holy Father. We were allowed to maintain our traditions and customs, and which makes us different than the Western churches. And, of course, the Western churches, they center more in Western Europe, mm-hmm. whereas the Eastern churches are originate in Jerusalem, the Middle East, and in Eastern Europe. So the Eastern Christians had their own traditions that are from Jerusalem, and they continue to this day. They take on the culture of the cities and the areas that they thrived in. The major cities, you know, for Christians, early Christians, was Jerusalem, Antioch, Byzantium, Rome, and Alexandria.
Right.
You know, so you have the Roman Catholics under Rome. You have the Byzantine Catholics in Constantinople, Byzantium. Alexandria would be your Coptics. And then Antioch, you have the Antiochians. You have your Chalcedonian churches. So each tradition originated from those particular major sees, and the culture, the music, they all would take on into their churches. The Eastern churches, they have a strong belief in a call to divinization, that all of us are called to be divinized, to become like God. There's the union with God through the holy mysteries, the sacraments. Mm-hmm. Then you have the public life of worship, fellowship, service. Then you have the secret life of prayer, fasting, and sharing. And then you have the need for spiritual warfare. These are, you know, the characteristics of the Eastern mind and Eastern Christians. The liturgy is so much to bring, not to bring God down, but to bring man up to God. And that's why the churches were very elaborate. The Annunciation is a good example of an Eastern church with a large dome with the all-powerful Christ in the center of the dome.
That is Christ the Pantocrator, correct?
The Pantocrator, that's correct. The all-powerful. And so it was to transport man into another world, to, you might say, be part of that kingdom that is already here on earth. And the worship is a gathering of the people, you know, and of course the church is in with the gathering of the people at prayer and the divine liturgy. And the ultimate union is to receive the body and blood of Jesus Christ. The sacraments are a little bit different in the Eastern churches. And this is where a lot of times, you know, my Roman priest friends, they just get very jealous of us Byzantine Catholics, especially when it comes to baptism, because our babies are baptized, they receive confirmation and Holy Communion all at one time.
Right.
And so the bishop gives the chrism to the priest, and the priests have the chrism, and they are able to chrismate or give confirmation to the newly baptized. We don't make a distinction between adult baptism and infant baptism. The way we baptize our babies, the same way we baptize our adults, our converts that come into our church. And the babies continue to receive communion, you know, as the mother and father bring them up for communion. We have infant communion.
Ah, okay.
But the form of communion also makes it easy for us to give communion to babies and infants, because we give the communion under both forms, the bread and the wine.
Right.
And so the babies usually receive a little bit of the precious blood from the chalice on a spoon. And of course, when the child is able to receive the larger particle of the bread, then the mother will tell the priest, you know, okay, now you can give him the larger particle for communion.
Right. Well, you know, two of the most striking elements of your liturgies, I think, and these they appeal very much to the senses, are the music and the iconography in the church. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the music is really important because everything is chanted or sung. Again, you know, the local areas, the different traditions form the liturgical music.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a definite art and system that is used for the liturgical music. It's in eight tones, and then from those eight tones, you have your matin tones, your vespers, your liturgy, and other services. Basically, the whole idea is to make the liturgy beautiful, but also that it would be heard in the large churches.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about Eastern Christians, and they didn't have PA systems and amplifiers like we have today. So the chanting and the singing would be easily heard in a large building,
mm-hmm.
especially a dome building, or you know, a dome that is, or where you have a building that is round. The sound would circle around. You just imagine Hagia Sophia in Istanbul. That is a Byzantine church.
Yes,
and you can imagine the great liturgies in that great church. And I'm sure that the music and the liturgy was well heard, you know, by the multitude.
Oh, yes.
That is the liturgy, you know.
Well, and the iconography in the church is very characteristic and very central to the worship. Is that so?
That's right. It's to basically, you know, you always have our dear fundamentalist Bible thumpers who say that we are, you know, making graven images.
Mm-hmm.
This, of course, if you know scriptures means graven images of idols.
Yes.
They are called images of people, you know, or the saints or God as idols, but and I think sometimes their thinking is misplaced. You know?
Yes, yes.
Because even the great temple in Jerusalem had images in the temple. If you read the scriptures, you know, about the construction of the temple by Solomon, you'll see that statues and images were around the temple and in the temple itself in the Holy of Holies.
Oh, yes.
But the whole idea was, you know, it comes from the fact that our Lord became man, the incarnation. the Nativity, the birth of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. And as a result, God is pictured as a man. He is here on earth. We can see him. So we have an image, and he is the image of the Father.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then, of course, all the saints, the whole idea that they are very much alive. You know, God is not the God of the dead, but of the living, you know. And when he says, you know, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you know, he is the God of the living. And, of course, they are very much alive.
Well, in the last couple of minutes we have, and I'm sorry, we have to limit it to 11 minutes today, I'd like to know about this. The liturgy is very participatory in nature, as I understand. Every person in the church is very involved in what's going on throughout. Is that so?
Very much so. Matter of fact, standing is the proper position in a Byzantine liturgy. Pews were kind of a recent innovation,
mm-hmm.
which kind of destroyed the atmosphere of worship. When you're standing, you're in an active position. I always tease our children. You know, they go to concerts, and they go country and western, or they go to rock concerts. I says, do you sit and watch the concert? He says, no, we all stand and we're cheering along. I says, okay, you know, what do you think we're doing in church? We're pretty much, you know, the standing is the active position. Sitting is a passive, where you're sitting to listen, to be, you know, for the homily, or you're listening to the Word of God. But even that, for the Word of God, we stand.
Well, Father, I hate to end here because there's so much more to talk about, and I would love to have you on the show again down the line, and we can pick it up and learn much more about the Byzantine Catholic Church, and particularly about Annunciation Byzantine Catholic Church in Anaheim, a wonderful place to visit. Father Stephen Washko, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today and for sharing your wonderful ministry.
Thank you, and God bless.
And blessings to you and your congregation.
Thank you.
And that's it for another edition of Orange County Catholic Radio. Please join us again next Thursday at 11 a.m. for another hour of good talk and intriguing topics. You're tuned to Immaculate Heart Radio, AM 1000 in Orange and San Diego counties, and to AM 930 in Los Angeles County. I'm Patrick Mott.
Right next to Disneyland, you can witness powerful dramas that inspire. Get your tickets now for the Christ Cathedral Drama Series at the beautiful Fried Theater on the Christ Cathedral campus in Garden Grove. Faustina, Therese, Tolton, and The Passion According to Luke. For ticket information, visit ChristCathedralCalifornia.org or call 714-282-3075. That's 714-282-3075.